You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
I've never been one of those people that loved being on the dance floor. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm one of those people who avoided being on the dance floor. I never felt really confident about that. It's a matter of my own comfort within my own skin and a matter of self-consciousness. And so I was always uncomfortable in that midst of dancing, which is why probably it was a little surprise when my fall of my senior year, I was taking social dance. Now, there was a reason I was taking social dance. My girlfriend, fiance at that time, was, and now current wife, wanted to take it. And so I decided that I would do it with her, not because I was so comfortable, but because sometimes love pushes you to do those things where you're a little bit uncomfortable. Nobody was more surprised than me to find out that I was pretty good at doing the waltz or the cha-cha, even the shag, which I had already knew how to do, but I actually was pretty decent at it. And I found that there were people in the class who actually wanted to dance with me, much to my surprise. Of course, my current partner was my dance partner even then. So we would dance through most of the social class, but every now and then, because there were more girls taking it than guys, I had to dance with somebody else and was actually pretty good at it, with one exception, and that was the tango. You see, the tango is a very ferocious dance, and a lot of drama, a lot of big presence to it, and a lot of self-confidence, and that was where I would still lack. And, you know, the tango had that everybody watching you passion to it, and it just never quite fit for me, which is why I always find it interesting that we use that "it takes two to tango" comment. In fact, this is kind of what brings us to what I wanted to talk about today. Many times when I talk to people about saving their marriage, that's how they tell me they're not going to do it. They say, well, it takes two to tango. You're telling me that I can work on this by myself, but it takes two to tango. And my response is, that is right. It does take two to tango, but I think we're taking that out of context. It takes two to tango, but you're already tangoing. Once you're married, you're already tangoing. You might not be tangoing well. You might not be dancing together well, but you are already doing the tango. So let's go back to one very clear distinction about the tango. It takes a very strong lead person. Now, let's get away just for a minute with the fact that in dancing the tango, the lead person, the strong personality there, is supposed to be the male, right? The male is deciding what to do. And that really is one of those things I realized when I was taking dances. The male is trying to follow a pattern and lead the female in very clear ways, without kind of being confusing and guiding the female through the process. Because in most traditional dances, as opposed to the dances these days, in most traditional dances, the male is the one who is deciding how to dance. So I want just for a moment for us to drop the gender piece, because otherwise we get stuck in who's going to take the lead. And my thing is, always it takes somebody to take the lead, but who it is, that's entirely up to the couple who decides to finally step up and say, you know what, we floundered long enough. Now let's see if we can get to somewhere different. I want you to notice that in the process that you're going through right now, it's possible that your spouse has taken the lead and said, you know, I'm not really wanting to be here, maybe even taken the lead by starting another relationship. And so part of our task here is to find how to change that, how to move it to a better place. So just for a moment, let's consider the fact that it does take two to tango, and you're already doing the tango. You know, if you use that analogy at the beginning of a relationship where you're trying to figure out if you're going to do the dance together, I would agree it does take both people to decide to work that relationship, but now you have. And so what we're really talking about here is whether you're going to dance it well or whether you're going to dance it all over the place, sometimes in sync with each other and sometimes way out of sync with each other. That's the reality of the tango that brings people to a relationship crisis. What I've noticed is that there's a typical cycle for most people, and certainly for most couples, and that is they get stuck in the hurt-blame cycle. The hurt-blame cycle is all about hurt feelings and dashed expectations. That's the hurt part, and then it's also about blame. Now, blame is an interesting thing because almost always with blame comes the belief, the self-reassurance that it's not my fault. Usually when there is a blame game going on, there is two people saying, not me, I'm not the one responsible for this. I used to have these kind of entertaining moments in my office. And when I say entertaining, meaning it was interesting to watch it happen, not that it was fun and enjoyable, but it was there's an entertainment factor to it because there was a story going on in my office. I would have two people sitting in my office, both telling me a story about why they are not at fault. Now, the way they posed it is how they had been hurt and how things had gotten out of hand, but it was always rooted in it's not my fault. And so both would tell a story about where the things had started. One spouse would tell me a story about how that spouse had been so deeply hurt, what had happened that had deeply hurt them. And then the other spouse would say, yeah, but before that, and they would tell me the story before the incident I just heard about. And that story would be one that cast them as the ones who were the ones faultless and the other person at fault. And then the other person would say, yeah, but, and they would go back one more step. And what I realized is they were willing to keep stepping back and back and back and back to tell me the story. And it was kind of like watching a movie and then watching the prequel and then watching the prequel to the prequel and then watching the prequel to the prequel to the prequel, and on it goes. And what we were really trying to do was to get to the sequel, to get to the grand finale where they walked down the aisle and they had made it through. They'd walked down the path. They made it through that canyon and they came out on the other side victorious. That was what we were trying to get to. And yet they kept wanting to go to their prequels. And so part of what my task was to stop that process, to get them away from the fault-finding mission and move to a different place. You see, that fault-finding thing is not new to the human race, but nothing happens good when we're stuck in the fault place. And when we're stuck in that hurt, blame cycle, we're not going to move anywhere different. That's why it's a cycle. It keeps repeating itself. The problem is it keeps repeating itself in a downward spin, a downward cycle, because each person gets more and more convinced that they are not at fault. So how far back does this go? Well, as far back as literature. If you look at the literature of the Greeks and Romans, they created mythologies that basically talked about how the gods were playing with the humans and that the gods would make the humans do things and create bad situations. It wasn't the humans' fault. It was the gods who were creating the bad circumstances. In fact, part of what we know of the deepest psychology of that far distant place was a belief that humans made no choices, that humans were always following the folly of the gods, and they were just following the leads of the gods, which is a nice way of getting yourself off the hook. But after the Greeks and Romans, the early Christians did the same thing. The devil made me do it, right? Or I'm fallen, or somehow I am incomplete, broken, and the devil made me do it. Now, we're not going to debate theology here, as much as I want to note that there is a new current way we do that, and that's to use psychology. In our current parlance, we talk about our unconscious drives that are due to, depending on what you watch, power, loss of meaning, our parents, often the parents, right? And so in a lot of our culture, we kind of joke about my mother created me this way, my father created me this way, some trauma created me this way. And the interesting thing for me, coming from my family therapy background, is that family therapy looks for the cycles. So if you have some psychological piece that comes from the parenting you had, remember that your parents had parents that led them to be that way, and their parents had somebody else that led them to be that way, and on it goes until we're at a place where we can never find who actually is responsible or at fault. So let's agree for this moment that the fault blame kind of game, the cycle of hurt and blame, really don't serve you very well. It really is only keeping you stuck in your current state of affairs with your marriage, and we've got to find a new way out. So here's the reality. Blame is a useless pursuit. All it does is keep us from responsibility, and that's where we begin to break the cycle. When we use, instead of the hurt-blame cycle, we use the acceptance-responsibility cycle, then so many things open up. And probably part of what you're thinking is, what do I have to accept, and why do I have to take responsibility? This isn't my fault. So let's talk a little bit about what I mean by these two pieces of the new cycle. And this is the cycle that brings you in an upward way, in an upward direction. First, acceptance. Acceptance is that where you are is, well, where you are. And whenever you're fighting against what is, it is a losing game. Acceptance is saying, okay, this is what's going on. Okay, I'm not getting everything I want, and I'm not putting in everything I should. This is where I am, though. This is my current spot. A lot of times people say, you know, if I accept where I am, then I'm stuck. And my response is, until you accept where you are, there's nowhere for you to go, because you're trying to fight against what is. You're trying to find ways to explain away what is, both as in your behavior and sometimes even your spouse's behavior. Sometimes it's an excusing yourself and blaming the spouse, but it's always looking for an alternative reality instead of what is. What is plenty to deal with. Whenever we're stuck in that place where we're trying to find something that we want it to be, or something that we want it to be so that we can relieve ourselves of any blame, then we're really getting more and more stuck. So acceptance is accepting where things are right now. And acceptance is partly by accepting that in rare occasions you've married someone who truly is evil, but in probably 99.9% and probably even higher, 99.99% of the cases, you've married someone who is doing the best they can where they are, that they're really trying to figure out how to live their lives. And the problem is they're stuck in the same cycle you are. When two people are stuck in a hurt blame cycle, which pretty much is what happens in a crisis relationship, you can't get out of it because both people are playing the negative game. The game changes when one or both switch it. So let's start with this assumption of acceptance, that your spouse really is doing the best he or she can do given where your spouse is right now. And that's an acceptance of reality, that people really do the best they can. People rarely are trying to hurt somebody on purpose. They may be hurting somebody because they've been hurt, but not in any other way. I often use this little story from my own history. I remember one time I found a dog that had been hit, and the dog had been hit. I'm sure the person who hit the dog didn't mean to, but had been hit with a car and was lying there and obviously in pain. And so I had a heavy jacket on, which I'm thankful for, but I wrapped the dog up in towels and I was taking the dog to the vet. Well, that dog in its pain latched onto my arm and grabbed hold tight. Now, I was fortunate because the dog never broke through my coat, but I could feel the strong pressure. It hurt on my arm because it was biting down. The reason it was biting down, not because it was angry at me or not because the dog thought that I was doing it harm, but because the dog was hurt and I was moving the dog, hurting it more. Whenever somebody is feeling hurt more, they tend to lash out in ways that are usually fairly destructive. And that's true for you too, right? And so part of what I always think about that dog latching onto my arm is that's exactly how I want to think of somebody who is doing mean things to me, that what they're really doing is lashing out of their own place of pain, that they're lashing out of their own frustration, and that when they're lashing out of their own place of pain and frustration, I can work on building some empathy. Now, let me extend that empathy one more place for you, and that is to yourself, to recognize that you are doing the best you can where you are, that you're doing all you can given the circumstances that you're in until you find something new. And that's the difference. We are always doing the best we can where we are right then, but when we get new information, when we get a new equipping, we can do differently. And that's the kind of the magic of self-improvement. I'm not saying that whatever you're doing right now is the best you can do. When I say people are doing the best they can where they are right now, what I'm saying is right now, this instant, given the pain, given the circumstances, given the knowledge base that's there. But when you get new equipping, new tools, new understandings, then you can step up to a different place. Then you can decide that you're going to act differently, that you're not going to do it the way you've been doing it, and you start doing the best you can given that new place. Same with your spouse. So first thing we do is we accept where things are. Where they are is where they are. And then we make a shift. And that shift is to decide to go from blame to responsibility. So what is the difference between the two? Well, blame is always saying, who caused this? And almost always, the blame is about looking outside of yourself for who caused this. Now, sometimes people say, okay, well, I messed up here. And I think we're off to a good start until they say, but, and they give me the reason that they messed up there. In other words, we excuse ourselves even when we start down that path of taking responsibility. This is about deciding that you're not going to play the who caused this game. No more whodunit. No more who's at fault. Because that's always very subjective and always multi-layered. And whenever somebody hears why the other person thinks that they caused it, they did it, they'll say, yeah, but. And the yeah, buts get more couples in trouble, more individuals in trouble than probably any other phrase where they say, yeah, that's true, but here is the rest of the story. Now, there's always the rest of the story, and it always is about not making a shift forward when we're looking for the rest of the story. It's always subjective, it's always multi-layered, and it's always impossible to unravel when you really think that that's the game. Instead of using that game, ask the question, what can I do from here? That's the magic shift to responsibility. What can I do from here? It's not about what's happened, but it's where I am now, acceptance of what is, and where can we go from here? How can I do that? Responsibility is not about blame at all. Responsibility is about saying, where do we go given the fact that we're here right now, and saying, how am I going to help us get there? It takes two to tango. The tango is deciding you're going to lead that dance for right now. Can you ultimately save your relationship all by yourself? Absolutely not, because at some point the spouse has to step back in. Otherwise, all you've done is enslave them. All you've done is capture them. But when you're trying to get your spouse to step back in, it takes two to tango, and you're going to take the lead right now and try to dance a different step. Try to be more clear about the steps. Try to be more precise about the steps. Try to make the steps make sense, because now you know some different ways of doing it. Maybe now you've learned a new method to the dance. Maybe you've learned the new steps to the dance, the new moves to the dance that you're going to do and bring back a renewed sense of dance to your relationship. So how do you do that? Let me suggest 8 steps to get there. The first one is start here. I've already said that, but this is about acceptance. Start here, not where you wish you were. Don't be thinking about where you should be at this point. Don't be thinking about what could be. Don't be thinking about the lost opportunities. Start where you are in the relationship right now. Start here. Number 2 is accept your role. And what that means is you both accept your role as the person who's going to take action, and you accept your role of where you've been. Because one of the important points of this new step is to make amends where you need to. If you look back and say, you know what, I really goofed up. There are some things I really need to apologize for, then you want to do that. That's the making amends. I talk about the apology letter to my VIP program members. I give them a formula for doing that, but you really want to make sure that you're apologizing. You know, if you're trying to figure out how to do that, I'm happy to help you in the VIP program, but you do want to make amends to say, hey, you know what? I've got to take responsibility for the things that I've done, the places I've fallen short, the places I know I could have done better. I accept my role and I want to move forward. And then 3, once you've accepted your role and you've made amends, you've got to move on. You can't keep playing back the past. I've had several people say, oh gosh, do I need to write another apology letter? And because that one didn't work, I need to write another one. And my response is, you've made amends. Now we move forward. Now we're not going to be caught with what happened in the past, because one of the games that couples play is that they start moving forward and then somebody wants to recall the past as a way of putting brakes on things. And sometimes I watch couples become haunted by that past, and the haunting recurs over and over. About the time they begin to feel a little more safe, they revisit the past. Revisiting the past is never a way of getting to the future. It may make some very interesting stories, and it may make for some speculation, but it never gets you to where you want to get to. You're always going to be stranded if always you're haunted by the past. So you start where you are, accept your role, make amends, and then you decide you're moving on. You're moving forward. Now, it's not a we're moving forward. It's you're moving forward. Sure, your spouse may have to bring up the past things, and you're going to have to apologize and begin to move forward as quickly as you can. There's no reason to keep rehashing what's already passed. The past is gone. It can't be changed. All that you have is this current moment and the future to aim towards as you move forward. So the next piece is to be clear on why you're doing this. Number four, be clear on your whys. I've done a podcast on finding your whys, and you can find a link to that just below the show notes on my website. If you're there, you simply look below the show notes, and you'll see the links below to all the important information. And one of them is the being clear about your why, because your whys are beyond your fears. The whys are the big reasons you're working on saving your relationship. If you lose touch of your whys, you'll get lost in the dance. You'll start doing crazy gyrations rather than staying on track with your dance, because the whys are what always drive us forward in the ways we want to, which then leads us to number five. Once you've got your whys, you got to get your tools. You got to gather up. You know, if you want to dance different steps, you got to learn the different steps. You got to practice the different steps. You got to learn the new turns, and you got to learn the new spins and the new dips and all those other things. So part of the change in this is saying, you know what? The tools we've had up until now have gotten us to here. They will not get us to a different place. We've got to retool. So go ahead and get your tools. Gather them up. If that's the Save the Marriage system, great. I would love to have you in that program. But whatever tools you gather, it's time to grab those tools and make sure you have them. Because the next step, number six, is to make your plan. The reason you want to make your plan is because once you have your tools, you have to kind of know which way you're headed. If you notice when people are dancing the tango, if they're really good, they often go in the same sequence. In fact, they get to the point where their partner kind of knows where they're going next. Whenever I watch the professional dancers, I happen to know that they've rehearsed that same sequence over and over and over. And they've got a plan. Their sequence is the plan. And it's the same with you. If you're going to get to change your dance steps, you've got to have your plan that's going to guide you through the process. Otherwise, you'll return to the past. You'll return to your emotions. You'll return to the blame game. You'll return to the hurt-blame cycle, and you'll lose ground. So you've got to make your plan and stick with your plan. After you've done that, after you've been working your plan, step number seven is to assess and fine-tune. Part of what I've come to realize is that life is not about failures. It's about tests. So I'll do something and it doesn't work, and I'll go, okay, I test it, right? Now I've got to fine tune and see if I can change that. I don't have to scrap the whole plan to fine tune it. It's kind of like the people who asked Thomas Edison about how it felt to have failed so many times in finding the right filament. And he said, I haven't failed. I've basically eliminated all those that don't work. And he continued to work until he found the one that did, but he was still working on the same project. That filament didn't fail. That didn't mean the experiment had failed. It meant that filament had failed. Let's try another one. He tried that. It didn't work. Let's try another one. He tried that. It didn't work. But he was still trying to do the same thing. He was just testing, not failing, but testing. So he was assessing and fine-tuning his experiment all along. And that's the reason why it's so important to have that plan ready to go. You want to be able to go back and say, okay, where did it work? Where did it not work? It's important to be assessing this every single day. That's part of the reason with my VIP members, I actually created a tool that helps them aim every single day of their lives in ways that are not just about their relationship, but about their whole life. That Thrive Journal is the way that they can kind of plug it in and keep on going. But you want to make your plan, assess and fine tune, and realize this is not about failure. It's about testing. And then the last step, continue. Continue is a big one. Something that I've noticed is a lot of times people will make some grounds. They'll begin to gain in the relationship. Things will start getting better. And then they stop. They think, okay, I've got it. Or they think, well, you know, I've done all I'm going to. And they stop. And they stop just short. The continuation is a lifetime project. Think about the fact that where you were headed has gotten you to here. That's not going to work. So we're changing the dance steps. We're finding new ways of doing it. And then you dance the new steps the rest of your life. You're going to dance a dance. You're going to dance the steps. The question is whether you're going to dance the ones that get you where you want to or the ones that keep you back. So as you get to this place, remember that this is a lifelong learning project. It's not drudgery, though. It's never about drudgery and things to dread and the day-to-day, oh my gosh, I've got to do it again. The learning process, the changing process, can be the most engaging part of your life. If you say, I am in a constant state of evolution, of change, of becoming, and I'm going to become all I can be, and I'm going to help our relationship become all it can be. When that happens, you've made the shift. You've made it from the moments of hurt and blame to the places of acceptance and responsibility, and your life unfolds before you. If you haven't grabbed my Save the Marriage system, I would love for you to do that. Grab the system. That's the basis of the work. If you've got the system and you're saying, okay, I'm ready to really step it up, join us in the VIP program. Learn how you can get some coaching and some help. If you really need some hands-on help, I do have coaches on staff, and I have limited space to work with people myself. One-on-one, we'll get together, or you can get together with my staff and talk about your plan and talk about your letter of apology and talk about how you take responsibility and talk about how you really show up to life. Whatever you're doing, though, take on the challenge. Take on those 8 steps. Take on those new steps and learn to do a great dance. Whether you've ever loved to dance or not, learn a new dance. This is Lee Balcom wishing you the best as you work to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.